Hello and welcome to the MDS podcast, the official podcast of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society. I'm your host, Sarah Schaefer, and the deputy editor of this podcast. And today we're going to do our third episode in the Hot Topic series on normal pressure hydrocephalus. If you haven't listened to the first two episodes, I recommend you go back and listen to those. And today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Joachim Kraus, who is both a movement disorders neurologist and neurosurgeon, I think a unicorn, professor of neurosurgery and chairman of the Department of Neurosurgery at Hanover Medical School in Hanover, Germany, and also the chair of the NPH study group at the MDS. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah. Hi, welcome everybody. Thank you very much. And it's a pleasure for me to speak about normal pressure hydrocephalus here.
So we've talked about the clinical aspects of NPH and differential diagnosis, some of the pathophysiological thoughts regarding NPH and co-pathology and controversies. What are the common ways patients with NPH are assessed, or people with suspected NPH are assessed to determine if treatment is indicated? And is this standardized? I've seen a lot of different ways that people do this, sometimes with a bedside large volume LP, sometimes with a lumbar drain. Is there a standardized procedure or data to support one avenue for assessment over another?
Yeah, this has been a problem since many decades, I must say, because there are several different diagnostic measures and tests which can be performed. And of course, when we say suspected normal pressure hydrocephalus, we have to think about what that means. And actually, the patient should have the typical clinic and the patient should have a clinical imaging. Sometimes patients with suspected normal pressure hydrocephalus may have typical imaging, but not typical clinics, or vice versa. And there the problem already starts. I've seen patients actually who were transferred for further diagnostics with suspected normal pressure hydrocephalus who actually did not really have hydrocephalus. Yeah. So hydrocephalus, there should be clear hydrocephalus, which can be defined by an Evans index, yeah, or some other measures. And these patients should have a typical imaging features. And I think that is now well established. Hydrocephalus plus a dash, disproportionately enlarged subarachnoid spaces, and tight high convexity, that means narrowed sulci over the parasagittal brain surface. And if we do not have these imaging findings and gait disorder, that might be disappointment later also with therapy. So I would say it is very important to have typical clinics in gait disorder, which is the main symptom, then maybe cognitive problems, urinary dysfunction, and movement disorder, slowness of movement, bradykinesia, and so on. But definitely we need a firm combination. And I think only when we have some of these combinations, we should go ahead. Because otherwise, if we do lumbar puncture, lumbar drainage, we most likely will not get a positive result here. And when we look at the story of diagnostic procedures, we also have to realize that normal pressure hydrocephalus is a hydrodynamic disorder. So it's not only a disorder of brain tissue, but also of brain fluid dynamics. And of course, this disturbance of brain fluid dynamics of CSF, of course, can be used as well for diagnosis. And that has been forgotten a little bit, but I think there will be a comeback on hydrodynamic studies, resistance to outflow, for example. Then patients do not really have normal pressure. They have slightly elevated intracranial pressure. And for example, 20, 30 years ago, we had overnight recordings to measure intracranial pressure. We had all of these hydrodynamic tests. And now the main diagnostic procedure actually is lumbar puncture or lumbar drainage. But there are many other tools that can be used. Okay, let's talk a little bit about lumbar puncture. Lumbar puncture should be done in a standardized way, and the clinical symptoms should be also recorded in a standardized way before lumbar puncture and after lumbar puncture. Then a lot of questions arise. Okay, how much of CSF should you relieve with the tap test? And as common agreement, it should be 30 to 40 milliliters. But still, some people do less. And then what is the result? Then the question is, when after lumbar puncture should we do the assessment? Same day in the evening, next day, 2 days later. And we recently published a manuscript on that. And there's a huge diversity in what has been published. But definitely, all patients with NPH who undergo the TAP test should have a standardized assessment for gait, velocity, number of steps, predefined lengths, what the patients are asked to go. And there are several possibilities. And also, of course, patients should be tested for cognitive abilities, MoCA or mini mental score examination, several different ways. And the highest predictability, of course, is the improvement of gait, and not only gait, maybe also posture after the TAP test.
So it sounds like you agree that this should be standardized. Absolutely, that makes sense. But in terms of when things are done, which exact test is done, and whether multiple tests should be done, an immediate and then a delayed, the jury's out on all of that. Is that correct?
There have been several recommendations, guidelines, and they differ in details from guideline to guideline. Yeah. And of course, the guidelines change over the years. And when we look 30 years back, people said that the main symptom of NPH would be treatable dementia. So we are completely away from treatable dementia, and we now talk about the treatable gait disorder mainly. Yeah? And it would be great if we could have a unified assessment that everybody would use, but I think we're far away from that. Because first of all, we have different habits, different fashions, I must say, in different countries also. And there is such a lot of literature favoring one method over the other that we are not there yet, that we have completely standardized assessment being performed in every place. So I would say each unit who looks into the diagnosis of non-pressure hydrocephalus should have a standardized assessment method that might be different from one unit to the other.
And you mentioned all kinds of gait outcomes that you're looking at, a MoCA or an MMSE for cognitive outcomes as well. It sounds like with all of the gait parameters that you look at, that a gait lab would be very helpful as opposed to just timing somebody walking down the hall. I wonder which outcomes may be expected to be more long-lasting versus temporary versus not expected to change with CSF diversion, and how, for example, you said that it used to be thought of as a reversible cognitive disorder, and now it's thought of as a reversible gait disorder. So what's the utility of testing cognitive outcomes when you're evaluating whether or not somebody is going to be a good candidate?
Yeah, so you are right. That is a problem. So again, I would say the main symptom we look at after the TAP test is gait. And the other tests are a little bit more problematic because if you use, for example, the mini mental state examination, if you have one day, then the next day, even if you have maybe a little bit a different version, but usually it's the same version you do, of course, there is some practice. So the patient knows what is expected. So the patient might be better with the mini mental state the next day just by knowing what he will be asked. Yeah. And also, cognitive dysfunction does not respond that rapidly to a TAP test like gait. So with gait, we see early improvement. And the problem is if we don't see really improvement of cognition as measured by MoCA or something, the patient might still benefit on the long term from improvement in cognition. And there's also some symptoms of NPH we do not really test in a standardized way, that is psychomotor slowness. So patients feel a little bit less energy, more lame, slow to respond, and that is not being tested with a standard test CG.
And do you ever consider the urinary dysfunction when you're doing these assessments?
Yeah, we already
not for diagnostic purposes, but for assessment of intervention.
Actually, we consider a urinary dysfunction for both because we always ask the patient, what's the problem with urination with micturition? And many patients will not tell you spontaneously, but if you ask, we have the urge to go to the toilet when you feel your bladder is full, they would say, oh, yes, exactly, that is it. And sometimes after the TAP test, the patient would say, I have less urge now for micturition. But again, there's no standardized test really that includes this item. But I think it's important.
Any movement clinician knows the number of suspected NPH patients that may be called by neuroradiology, consider NPH as a diagnosis, right, is huge compared to the number who might ultimately be diagnosed. And published data demonstrates that potentially even smaller populations respond favorably to shunts with sustained outcomes. There may be some temporary outcomes. What should providers be thinking about to critically determine who might best benefit from an intervention?
Yeah, we have to consider now that we have a lot of comorbidity in NPH. We have patients with cerebral vascular disease, which might be part actually of the diagnosis of NPH in some patients. For example, it's being thought that arterial hypertension might be a predisposing factor for the development of INPH. On the other hand, we have a comorbidity with Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, or PSP. Maybe there's a subtype of PSP with more NPH-like symptoms as well and with enlargement of the ventricles. And now the problem is if you have a patient that is more on the less comorbidity side of NPH, okay, it's clear we would offer a shunt when we have the typical symptoms and improvement of TAP test. And the other question, of course, is if we have more comorbidity, huge amount of dementia, PSP-like symptoms, what should we do with this patient? Yeah, should we offer shunt surgery or should we say we had only little improvement in the TAP test, but still some? And maybe this is comorbid PSP. And should we refrain from shunting these patients? Very difficult question. I think it has not been solved yet. And especially if we look at the long-term outcome data and differentiate, there's remarkable differences. Yeah? So we have in some years, we have long-term follow-up improvement of 50 to 80% after 3 to 5 years. Then we have other studies with long-term improvement, 30%, maybe even less. And I think the main reason for that is twofold. One is the comorbidity. So maybe these years are completely different. Yeah, some have more comorbidity, the other years less. And then, of course, also it's the dedication to the shunt technology, which plays a role. And that is often being neglected.
Can you explain that a little bit more?
Shunt technology has evolved tremendously over the past 30 years. So the usual technique was VP shunt with a differential pressure valve. And in the meantime, of course, we have programmable valves. We have gravitational anti-siphon devices in addition. And we can manipulate the CSF flow in certain ways. So I consider, in a way, shunting as a form of neuromodulation. Yeah. So the shunt, in a way, is like the DBS electrode and the programmable valve in a little bit like the pacemaker. And so we have to think more in that way also. And then, of course, we can modify outcome in a way. And the future technology in my thinking is that we have artificial intelligence-driven shunts that adapt themselves more to the state of the patient. So like we could have external markers, but we could also measure intracranial pressure and regulate the outflow. And I think with that thinking, this is completely different, just like putting a valve with a fixed setting and then the patient improves or doesn't improve, yeah?
Smart valves or smart shunts.
Smart shunts, absolutely. I think that is the future. Yeah.
Well, that's really cool. So it sounds like there's probably just a lot of shared decision making and going on when you're counseling patients, especially if they might have vascular disease or Alzheimer's pathology or other things, in order to temper their expectations, but see whether the amount of improvement that you might expect or the range of improvement you might expect is worth it for them. But that if somebody has co-pathology, it's not off the table because there may be multiple things going on and you might be able to take that top layer off of their symptomatology. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, it's even in series when it is being said that there was only transient improvement for 2 years. And then the clinical picture deteriorates in some patients. So then the discussion is, should these patients be excluded from shunting? But you could also say, why not shunt these patients? At least they have improved for 2 years. And with current shunt technology, low complications rate, this is different than it was 30 years ago. 30 years ago, there were some published studies and with horrendous complication rates, high morbidity, even high mortality, high morbidity. And with the new valve technology, new valve generation, this is quite different. Yeah, so there should be actually no mortality with procedures, and morbidity with a programmable valve should take care of under drainage or over drainage. So this is a different picture. But as it is with many other aspects of everything, people still will talk about data that is 20 or 30 years old. So when we talk about shunting, I think it doesn't really make sense to look at the data from the 90s.
There's a lot of staying power to that stuff. I understand, yeah. Absolutely. Thinking about co-pathology and how that might change the calculus and also change the conversation with the patient, do you think that patients who are being evaluated for possible shunt and surgical intervention should be automatically tested for at least the pathologies that we can test for at this time? Amyloid, synuclein, tau is a little bit more difficult, of course. But do you think, is that part of your normal protocol, or only if they exhibit certain symptoms that might point you in that direction?
Now we are touching, I think, on a very difficult topic, because there has been a quest for the biomarker of NPH for many years, and people talk about the biomarkers of NPH. Now, I think it will be difficult to have really a biomarker for NPH, but what we have is biomarkers for co-pathology. And then, of course, the question is, how do we define NPH? And I hope we will get rid of this idiopathic at some point of time. And then if we say this is co-pathology, of course, this is completely different than if we say this is part of the spectrum. So should we say NPH is a spectrum disorder, which might include Alzheimer's disease, which might include patient with PSP, or should we say these are different entities coming together in a way, yeah, and different combinations? I think we have to start to collect biomarkers, but this should be done on a large scale with big data. Because again, if we look at single center studies or even small cohort studies, the investigators have different ways to select the patients or what they think they should be shunt candidates or not. So it would be good if you have really big data, let's say 10,000 patients, and then I think this would be much easier to have some conclusion in the end, what would be beneficial. And of course, patients with mainly gait disorder and less co-pathology, but still it would give a clearer picture for the many co-pathologies. When should we offer shunt surgery, and also at the timing of shunt surgery? Should we do this early? Is it sometimes maybe too late to offer shunt? Does it not make sense any longer? And all of these questions basically remain partially unanswered.
Okay, so you've touched on a couple of future directions or priorities that you think should be looked at in the field. A couple that you mentioned were the smart shunt, as it were, large data collection, multi-center data collection of biomarkers, maybe a standardization of protocols. What do you think are the next steps and what do you think should be prioritized, or what is your study group prioritizing?
Well, we just looked into the evolution of NPH, and that has been a neglected topic. And of course, it would be great if we could find something to prevent the progression of NPH. So let's say we have a patient with a mild gait disorder, no dementia, no urinary dysfunction, but we have the typical imaging of NPH. Then it would be great to find something to stop the evolution. Then maybe the patient never needs a shunt. But the problem is that we do not know what are the factors that facilitate the progression of the development of NPH. Yeah? Maybe one factor is arterial hypertension. So should we treat maybe hypertension more thoroughly? This patient also has a sleeping disorder. Should we treat the sleeping disorder? And that is completely unclear. So that would be one of my future focuses, prevention of progression. Then, as you said already, we need more data about the co-pathology benefit of shunting in these patient groups. And as we discussed briefly before, the smart shunt technology. And last not least, CSF fluid dynamics. That will come back, I'm pretty sure. If we do a lumbar puncture, of course, we have the possibility to investigate also fluid dynamics, which is rarely being done now.
All right, you've given us a lot to chew on. Do you have any last thoughts for our listeners as we wrap up this Hot Topic series?
Yeah, of course. I think it's very important to know the clinical picture. It's very important that movement disorders specialists look into NPH, because there are neglected issues like bradykinesia. Many patients who do not have concomitant Parkinson's disease or PSP have bradykinesia. And this bradykinesia could even also be used maybe as a predictor for a shunt improvement. There's so many unresolved issues. And also, I think we are now approaching a phase of hope with NPH. Yeah, we know that we can help these patients, and at least in some temporarily, not forever. And I'm very glad that we have this podcast in the Movement Disorder Society, because this gives more attention to this still, I would say, enigmatic disease.
Sounds like the perfect field for our bright-eyed and bushy-tailed junior members and listeners to go into.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All right. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate the discussion.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for your question. And thanks to the audience for listening.
The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.